the author of numerous books, the one that is perhaps most prominent and known to us is More Guns Equals Less Crime. John Lott, please.
Well, thanks, Julianne and Alan, for setting this up. Appreciate it. Let me just... Okay. All right, thanks. Well, I appreciate all the talks I've been listening to, a lot of valuable information there. I want to talk about something I think, just to warn you about, that's coming down the pike, because I think it's kind of depressing, and that is there's going to be an avalanche of gun control research coming out. And I think I'll just give you a few examples of things that are going to be changing. Earlier this year, Michael Bloomberg gave about $250 million to the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. They're going to be hiring something like over 40 new academics. They already have 8 academics dealing with gun control issues, but I don't even know how you can have 48 people at one university dealing with a topic like that. Probably at least as bad, in January, President Obama met with 23 foundations that in the past had been dealing with healthcare research. And his message was, look, we've won the healthcare debate. You should start focusing on gun control. I don't know how much you follow the healthcare debate. I've done some research in that area also. And over the years, you know, almost monthly or sometimes even more often than that, Kaiser, Wellness Foundation, others be spending tens of millions of dollars having new studies that would come out that would go and say, you know, the American healthcare system is broken. We need to have a type of system that they have in Canada or in Europe. And, of course, the media would just go and have headlines broadcasting these new studies. I think they were pretty poorly done, but it was just kind of Chinese torture in terms of, you know, new study after new study coming out and getting very uncritical coverage in the media. And then, of course, earlier this year, one of the president's executive orders was essentially to order the Centers for Disease Control and other government agencies to start to use federal funds to go and fund other gun control research. The problem that I have with that is that it's very difficult for the government to divorce politics from academic research there. And so you're going to have tens of millions more dollars. So you add this up, $250 million from Bloomberg, tens of millions, probably many tens of millions from these foundations, and then you have the federal government weighing in. And you're going to see regularly, I mean, we've just seen in the last week, there's been 3 studies that have come out, one claiming things about gun ownership rates across countries. I'll talk more about that general point in a minute, and saying that countries that have more gun ownership are associated with more gun deaths. There was one that came out on suicides, and there was another one looking across states and gun ownership. Just 3 in this last week. You look over the last month, you look over the last 3 or 4 months, and you're really starting to see these things come out, and they get a lot of news coverage when that happens, and it's going to have an impact on the debate. One of the studies that got the most coverage, I think by far, there was a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that came out this spring, which was claiming that, again, the states with more gun ownership were associated with more gun deaths. I'll just give you an idea how poorly done these studies are and how little the media kind of understands even what questions to ask. So if you do a Google News search on this study, it got like 890 news hits, 92 news hits in the 1 week after it was released. And what they do is, you know, the media says, well, they measured gun ownership rates in different states, and they compared that to gun deaths. Seems simple and straightforward enough. The question is, how did they measure gun ownership? Media doesn't even think about asking something like that. Well, they measured gun ownership by looking at gun suicides. If you have more gun suicides in a state, that means you must have more gun ownership. Well, The problem is even worse than that. And the reason why it's worse than that, because they're trying to relate gun deaths to gun ownership. And so what's gun deaths? Gun deaths are two things. They're primarily gun suicides as well as gun homicides. So what you're really doing, you're measuring, you can call it gun ownership, but you're measuring gun suicides. And then on the other variable is gun suicides plus gun homicides. And I know I'm glad this was explained to me because I wouldn't have guessed it before. But if you increase gun suicides, you have more gun suicides. And so they get... Now, it's not perfectly correlated because they're also adding in gun homicides there. But if a student had written a paper like that, I probably would have taken them aside and explained that there was a problem with what they were doing. But as I say, that study got extensive coverage in the media, and I couldn't find anybody that would even ask a question, well, how do you measure gun ownership? When I do a study and it gets news coverage, I guarantee you they're going to find some critic out there to go and interview and say, well, what do you think of Lott's research there? And they'll say something about it. But for some reason, when they go and they report these other journal articles on the other side, and this public health research is really poorly done, they never seem to be able to find anybody to be critical of it. There's studies that came out in the last week. I'll just mention one looking across countries. There's been actually several of these studies. I don't know, you'd think the media would just say, well, didn't we just write on this a few months ago? But what they use is this small arms survey out of this organization in Geneva. And they'll go, and this is the data that they use, and that measures guns per capita. It's something that's been used a lot in the UN debate. I'm sure Julianne can talk about this. And if you read the New York Times, I didn't even try to keep count, but I'm sure it's like at least 20 times or something since Newtown, they've referenced this small arms survey. Well, according to the small arms survey, the United States is way out there in terms of gun ownership rates at like 88 per 100 people. I wouldn't even measure it that way if it were my druthers. I would go and have percent of the population with guns rather than number of guns per capita. But there's a bigger problem with that, and that is since they say the United States is all way by itself out there, it really affects any relationship you have. But they say that Israel, for example, only has about 7 guns per 100 people. They say, now, you know, if you know for concealed carry, for carrying guns in Israel, you have about 15% or up to about 15% over the years of the adult Jewish population in Israel has been allowed to legally carry handguns. So that's just handguns. And that's not even all of them. The thing is, the way they get around this is that the government in Israel technically owns most of the guns. You know, you can possess it. You can possess a gun for decades. But the small arms survey, they say, well, you know, we're not counting this because it's technically not owned by the people. It's owned by the government. But the issue is, if a gun's in somebody's home, if it's something they're carrying around, and if we're concerned about civilians having access to guns, it really shouldn't matter whether it's technically owned by the government or individuals. Who has access, who has possession of the guns? And the same thing with Switzerland. This data was from 2007. They would go and say that only 47 guns per 100 people in Switzerland. But what they did was they didn't count all the military weapons that at that time were in people's homes. You know, whether it was machine guns or handguns that were issued by the government, and because the government technically owned those military weapons. But if the issue is the concerns about people having guns in their home, if that's the concern, which is supposedly the whole point of this relationship that these studies are looking at, it seems like you'd want to count that. And if you were to even just those two countries kind of give a reasonable measure, it completely changes the type of public debate that we see on these types of things. Here's the problem. Somehow, we have to be able to quickly respond to these types of claims. When you have these studies come out, you know, you only basically have a day news cycle or something to respond to these things. And I worry that the existing kind of institutions that we have there just are not able to respond or don't respond to these studies and claims when they come out. So what I've been trying to set up is something called the Crime Prevention Research Center, website set up, and I've gotten some donations. But let me just give you an idea of some of the stuff that I think can be done, that needs to be done, the types of studies that I think have to be done. One is we need to document how the high fees imposed on purchasing guns and licensing reduce gun ownership. You know, Dave Kopel was just up here, and he was talking about even though the fee isn't high in terms of $10 for getting a gun in Colorado, it's essentially working, I would call it as an economist, a price control. You know, if I were to go and say, well, geez, the government says you can get gasoline for 10 cents, sounds great, right? How much gasoline is there going to be when you have that type? There's going to be no gasoline out there, obviously. Nobody's going to take it out of the ground and sell it. Or you could have the fee being too high. So look at some of the laws that we've had enacted this year. To go through a background check in New York State, on average, as my understanding, takes about $85 fee that you have to pay an FFL to go through. You have to go through an FFL and get a background check to go and buy ammunition in New York State now. So that means essentially you have an $85 effective tax that's imposed when you want to go and buy even one bullet, or you buy 100 or whatever. It's still this $85 fee that you have to pay. In Maryland now, it's going to be costing well over $300. We still don't even know exactly what all the fees are going to be there to go and license and register a handgun. And if you live in Washington, D.C., according to the Washington Post, who had a reporter who went through this, Emily can talk about for her own experiences, but the Washington Post even was claiming it would cost $534 to go through the process. Maybe it's a little high for different reasons, but there are all sorts of time costs for the individuals that are involved there. Here's what I think needs to be done. I think one needs to go and know not only the impact this has on gun ownership, because I believe they're doing this as a way to get around the Heller and McDonald decisions. They can't ban all guns, but if they can impose a tax, they can reduce gun ownership. And so right now they can go and impose what turns out to be very high taxes. The other thing that I think is important is that it's very discriminatory. You look at Washington, D.C. or Chicago up until the rules that they are changing to now, who has been able to go and get guns? In Washington, D.C., it's basically wealthy whites that have been able to do it. Poor blacks, the people that my research tells me benefit the most from being able to go and own guns, are the people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime. Yet they're the ones who are being priced out of the opportunity to be able to go and get guns for self-defense that's there. And I think it has a real impact. So, you know, you may only have in Chicago a few thousand people that have been able to go through the process to go and license and register a handgun in the city. You know, out of 2.5 million people, you don't expect much of a benefit in terms of crime. But it's even smaller than that number would imply, because you're not getting the people who benefit the most from being able to go and get guns. You're not getting the people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime being able to go and obtain it. So another example, I mentioned the small arms survey. It'd be nice to go and put together an alternative measure there that I think is more realistic and explain why all the news media that's been using this bias survey, you know, because they use this, everybody says, well, it's the only data that's available, and it infects the entire debate that we have there and is used to help push gun control laws around the world. You know, a third example are these background checks. David Kopel was just talking about a mess that the background check system in Colorado is in. I think it's even worse than what he was talking about. You go and you look at the federal data, and I would argue the annual NICS report isn't very clear on exactly what the problems are that they have with it. But I believe that you're talking about conservatively at least 96% and probably over 99% of the rejections, the initial denials, are false positives. law-abiding citizens who should be able to go and obtain a gun are stopped from doing so because they have a name that's similar to somebody that the government wants to stop. So, you know, an analogy is the late Senator Ted Kennedy. 5 times he was on the no-fly list. 5 times he was prevented initially from flying a plane. Now he later flew. I assume, even if it's Ted Kennedy, we wouldn't count that as 5 times we stopped a terrorist from flying, right? But that when the president goes and says there have been 2 million prohibited people that have been prevented from buying guns because of federal background checks, the right terminology is that there have been 2 million initial denials that have occurred. And he's essentially assuming that all those initial denials are people that we really need to count. It's like counting the 5 times with Kennedy is 5 times we need to stop a terrorist. And I could go on. There's other things. I think this is an international debate that's going on. But somehow we have to have something that can respond quickly and also change the debate by going and putting out research that makes them have to respond on these things. You just can't deal with the legal front, and we just can't deal with the PR thing in terms of being on the TV and radio, but we have to go and have studies, because I think that those will affect those others. So that's the reason why I'm trying to set up the Crime Prevention Research Center. If you go on the web, you can see it's crimepreventionresearchcenter.org, though we're going to be getting a more professional website and other things being set up on it. Anyway, thank you for your time.